Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this Talks with Authors program on Professor Eric Claes's recently published book, Natural Property Rights. We're very pleased to have the author joining us today for this discussion on his publication. Eric Claes is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School of George Mason University. And we're very thankful to Ken Davis, who is a former Deputy Attorney General for Virginia, for moderating the discussion today. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. And if you'd like more information or to purchase a copy of the book Natural Property Rights, the link can also be found there on the event page. Near the end of the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Eric and Ken, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Well, thank you, Edith, for that introduction, for making the program possible. And especially for giving me a wonderful opportunity to talk with Eric Claes about his new book, his important, consequential, splendid book. And let me start by asking him how you came to write this book. I mean, any book, writing any book is a big undertaking, but to go through the labor and the research to produce a book like this is a terrific and substantial undertaking. How did it come to be?
Okay, I want to thank the Federalist Society first for hosting this webinar, and thank Ken for being the moderator today and for being so enthusiastic about this project. And to answer that question, it's going to be kind of a long answer, but I guess the short version of it is there's some ideas that don't fit well into a 750 word opinion editorial or a 10,000 word article. And so I've taught property since I started being as a tenure track professor, and I wrote an article about regulatory takings law called Takings Regulation and Natural Rights, placed in the Cornell Law Review in 2003. And so I've been writing about natural law, natural rights, and property since I started as a professor now 25 years ago. And when, like, as my scholarship got out there, I started to notice that other scholars would dismiss what I was saying about property and natural law and natural rights. And there were a lot of different objections to natural law and natural rights that were offered out. And they were offered as devastating threshold objections, that reasons why, that, like, you don't have to even to think another minute about natural law and natural rights. And as I reacted to the first several of those criticisms, I thought about it and said, that just can't be right. Natural law is a way of thinking about politics and about individual ethics that goes back at least 1800, 1900 years. Natural rights, or it's a more recent concept, but it's an important concept in the West for 400 years. And if you look at the development of property, the people who contributed more than anybody else to making property a distinct and respectable institution were Grotius, Pufendorf, Locke, Blackstone, and Chancellor Kent in the U.S. And they all developed and worked out what it meant for property to be a natural right. And so I then said, I need to find some way to respond to these objections and try to explain to a contemporary audience how natural law and natural right might inform property. And it seemed to me that when we're right, you can't write an article in a law review or a peer-reviewed academic journal about dealing with objections like those. contemporary articles and in peer-reviewed scholarship or law-reviewed scholarship, they need to be on things that are a lot more topical about what's going on in the scholarship or what's going on in the courts or what's going on in legislatures. And so it seemed to me then I needed to deal with a lot of the threshold objections to natural property rights in a longer publication, and one that's not tied to some periodical. I'm grateful that Cambridge University Press wanted to publish the book, and Cambridge University Press has a web platform. So if anybody who is associated with a university library that's got a subscription, so people can get to the book on the web through university libraries. And Cambridge also publishes hard copies, as they will now. In another year, they'll publish a softbound copy that'll be a lot cheaper. So the idea is just to put out in one place the best case I can make how natural law might inform property, how property can be the subject of a natural right, and why a lot of the most common criticisms of natural law and natural rights aren't as convincing as they are often suggested to be in more topical scholarship, and put that out there for people to consider.
Thank you. That is, I think, very helpful to put this project in the book into a broad, deep context. Now, you mentioned audiences. Who specifically is your intended audience, or the audiences that you're trying to reach here?
There are several, Ken. I guess the innermost ones, the ones I'm focusing on most are people who write in political theory, philosophy, or law from an academic perspective, and in particular, people who write about political theory, philosophy, or law, and are they're interested in the subject of property. And then I'm also interested in trying to be in a conversation with academics who write about natural law, and they focus more on natural law and jurisprudence, and they haven't thought as much about particular topics like property. And then I guess the last part of the most intended targets are people who are entering law school now and people who are entering the academy now as grad students in political theory or philosophy. I want to reach the next generation. I think that a lot of the contemporary scholarship about property in political theory, in law, or in philosophy, there are shortcomings in it. And it's hard for younger scholars to get an adequate account about how property can be justified in a satisfying manner. And I hope this book gives them a 300-page account that they can think about and ask whether the contemporary scholarship is doing a fair job talking about natural law, natural rights, or property. I also hope that the book gives ideas to people who are political organizers, people who write opinion pieces about property in contemporary politics and law, or people who might be like organizing litigation that has to do with property and cutting edge issues. But I wouldn't say they're my primary intended audiences. People like that, I'm happy to talk to them more to explain how the book is relevant to what they do. The book needs to be a bridge between the theory and the book to cutting edge issues in legislation, regulation, or lawyering.
Well, I certainly wish the book had been available when I was in law school and graduate school, but at least it is now. Now, the title, Natural Property Rights. So are you talking about the rights affirmed in the Declaration of Independence and famous paragraph 2?
Yes, and I could leave that as just saying yes and move to your next question, but I guess here I want to bring out one of the devastating threshold objections that I mentioned in answering your first question. It is when in contemporary legal scholarship and some contemporary philosophy scholarship, when someone mentions natural rights, writers will say natural rights must mean rights of autonomy, where the rights of autonomy must be respected no matter what the consequences are on other right holders or on the public. And I devote a whole chapter in the book to saying that's not the kind of right, like natural rights could be understood in that way, but they don't have to be. And they're not understood that way in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution of Virginia, many other state constitutions that were written from 1775 to 1830. And they're not as understood in Grotius and Pufendorf and Locke. So there's another understanding of natural rights that I call, the one I criticize, I call in the book a Nozickian understanding of rights. But I'm not advancing and defending a Nozickian understanding of natural rights. I'm understanding one that's more consistent with the Declaration of Independence and the Declaration of Rights at the beginning of the Virginia Constitution. And in those accounts, natural rights are the rights that people have when their rights are ordered consistent with more basic principles of natural law.
Two are connected because in the Declaration, in the first paragraph, the founders invoke the laws of nature, saying that we're assuming our rightful place as an independent country according to the laws of nature. So could you talk more about what the relationship between natural rights and natural law is?
Absolutely. And chapter two of the book covers that exact topic. Chapters two and three try to explain how I understand more basic principles of natural law and natural rights, and then I apply those lessons to property in the last 12 chapters of the book. So I guess the place I'd start is talking about why do people engage in certain courses of conduct. And before there was natural law, Aristotle wrote about this, and natural lawyers took a lot of Aristotle's teaching and made it more systematic. And Aristotle's answer is people always have a reason for whatever they do, and the most satisfying, persuasive reason to do anything is because it makes you happy. And there are some courses of conduct that lead to gratification or satisfaction or happiness that are solid, they're long lasting, they're durable, and they're grounded in objective reality. So natural law is a way of thinking about human life, and in it, the point of human life is to pursue courses of action that provide rational, objectively defensible happiness or flourishing or gratification. And things that give an actor objective good are things the actor should do. And so natural law is a way of thinking about practical life and ethics and politics and law that says people should do things that are going to contribute to objective happiness for themselves and the people around them. And if something is an objective good, then so say life or say practicing a virtue like charity, if things that are good that way, an actor had two obligations follow out of that. On one side, the actor ought to do things that produce objective good. And on the other hand, when the actors are doing things that are objectively good, other people should respect that person's freedom to carry out what's objectively good. And so there's a natural law duty to do things that are good and a natural right not to be interfered with in doing things that are good. So then applied to property, intelligent actors have certain tendencies. They can work or be lazy. They can be technical or not curious. But if they apply their industry and their technical curiosity to take things that are not people and convert them into things that are more useful for human survival or human thriving, that's good. And people have a responsibility to engage in that kind of activity to produce things for themselves and others. And as they do so, they're entitled to natural rights not to be interfered with as they act productively.
So you talk about the pursuit of happiness. And in fact, in the first draft of the Declaration, it was life, liberty, and property. So there's a real connection there, but it's not just any happiness. I mean, drug lords and gangsters might at a moment say, well, this next crime makes me happy. But you're talking, are you not, about happiness and flourishment and activity and behavior that is consistent with the natural law. So natural law directs behavior, or it should direct behavior, towards a flourishing, a fulfillment of natural rights that's in accordance with the natural law.
That's all right, Ken. Yeah, happiness is another term that could be understood different ways. It could mean any old fleeting happiness, or happiness in people who are bad actors. But there's another understanding where happiness means flourishing, or what Aristotle called eudaimonia, having good spirits. And that second understanding is happiness consistent with principles of human well-being that are understandable by reason. And in the declaration, happiness has to be understood consistent with, as you said, the laws of nature and nature's God. So it's happiness understood consistent with sound philosophy and sound theology.
So we're talking about, when we talk about people having a natural property right or anything else, we're talking about a certain kind of person, a person who, you said, can reason, and a person who has a moral sense. They can discern right from wrong, and they'll hopefully make the right choice. It's that kind of person, right?
I guess I have two answers to that, Ken. Like, the kind of person you just mentioned is the kind of person you hope is you hope you have 100 of them in the legislative branch, and you have several hundred of them being judges, and several other thousands of them being good appellate lawyers, and people like that are doing the craftsmanship work to work out a property system. I guess I resist answer you're putting in your question. And everybody has these natural rights, but people who are spoiled, people who are not well educated, people who are vicious, they're more likely to abuse their rights. But they still have these rights, and they still have responsibilities to respect other people's rights. And one hopes that you have good people in the legislature, in the executive, in the judiciary, crafting positive laws so that people have secure natural rights.
Well, how does a person, as a first step, acquire a natural right to any piece of property, an acre of land or whatever? How does a person acquire or realize their natural right in property?
So that question is a question I'm trying to answer in three or four chapters of the book after chapters 2 and 3. So chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7 are explaining what a natural right to property is. And I guess I wanted to say, so there's two, I think the main way I try to offer natural rights in the books, a natural right provides a standard for evaluating and critiquing particular customs, particular conventions, and particular laws that touch on property. So in a system of where there's already lots of positive laws, it's kind of fanciful to say that somebody acquires a natural right in a particular thing. If you acquire, you try to claim a natural right in something that's already owned, there's something not right about that. But as an abstract matter, you can assume that all the resources in a community should be for the use of everybody in the community. And so you can ask, as an abstract matter, if the laws in this community were well written and well structured, what would they be doing? And a natural right provides an answer to that question. And so if you were to temporarily pretend that all the positive laws were not enforced and say that all the resources were up for grabs, you would then ask, so what should somebody do to demonstrate a strong connection to a resource, and a connection that's strong in a way that entitles that person to a natural right? And so chapter five tries to answer that question. And the answer goes like this, that like in principle, any resource should be available for the use of anybody in the relevant political community. But some people, by their conduct, can do things to establish a closer connection to resources that are not yet claimed than others. And the first step of that is of that conduct is to put the resource to what I call in the book a productive use. And I mean by productive use pretty much the same thing that John Locke meant by labor. And productive use and labor mean intelligent and purposeful activity that try to produce survival or some form of flourishing for the actor or someone else. So by putting a resource to productive use, the user's establishing a morally valuable connection that entitles them to say, I'm now putting this resource to a use for survival or thriving. You're not yet doing so. My use gives me the start of a right. But that use is necessary. It's not sufficient because since everybody else in the community is entitled to acquire and use resources too, when someone starts using a resource, the user ought to give courteous, respectable, sociable notice to everyone else. I'm using this resource and I've signposted my use and I've signposted my intention that I'm going to keep engaging this use. So I call the second requirement claim communication. And what I say about claim communication owes a lot to what Grotius and Pufendorf in their treatises about international law, when they talked about property, they talked about possession and occupancy. But I think possession and occupancy mean conduct that signposts to other people in a community that someone who's a user intends to claim an exclusive right going forward. So the productive use and communication of claims to others who are not yet right holders, those establish a defeasible or a rebuttable or a prima facie right. But then since resources are in principle for everyone's use, someone who's not a right holder on a resource can override that prima facie right. And there are two provisos or two grounds for override. In common law, in tort and property, law students learn about two cases called Plouffe versus Putnam and Lake Erie versus Vincent. They're cases about necessity. And so one person needs to use another person's dock to protect a boat in a storm. And that necessity idea is expressing in law one of the provisos of morality. If one person needs to commandeer another person's property temporarily to avoid a threat to life or a wipeout or destruction of property, the necessity proviso allows for a limited use of a resource someone already has a natural right in. And then when one creates a natural right in a resource, one can never claim the right to the point that one excludes so much of a resource that one's not leaving what Locke called enough and as good shares of the same kind of resource in community. And if one consumes more than enough and as good, then others may use what I call in the book the sufficiency proviso to press back and limit that natural right. So again, a natural right is earned by productive use and communicating one's claim of exclusive use, but then the claim that like the right is limited in principle by the necessity and sufficiency provisos. And what then has to happen is that legislatures, judges, and regulators should be trying to write positive laws that strike the right balance between productive use and claim communication on one side and sufficiency and necessity on the other side.
No, the positive law, whether it comes from legislature, court, court decisions, or wherever, translates the natural right that is established by putting the property to productive use into, I'll say, a actionable, moderated, integrated right that can be reconciled with the other rights and claims and disputes and members of society.
Right? That's right, Ken. Let me say a little bit more about that because that's a important theme in the book. So I covered this at most length in chapter 3. It's a chapter called Property and Practical Reason. And so the phrase, the practical reason, it's a philosophical term of art. And in one of its usages, it talks about, it's a term of art that explains and makes clear how people start with very general, not well-formed ideas about rights and duties and turn them into specific courses of conduct in individual ethics or specific laws and policies in law. And what you called in your question translation, there's two terms of art that are known from philosophical scholarship. One's called specification and one's called determination. And specification is the process by which people take a general right, like a right to property, and then turn it into a series of specific rights and responsibilities. Like, so there's a natural right to property. You specify the natural right by coming up with productive use and claim communication as requirements, and then sufficiency and necessity as overrides or provisos on the natural right. And then when you know what the well-specified natural right looks like, you then need positive law to carry the specified natural right into practice. And here, I wrote that chapter in part to explain how general natural rights get turned into guides to specific laws, but I also wrote that to beat back, to respond to another one of these threshold objections. So one of the threshold objections is natural rights provide no guidance. There's two related objections. On one hand, natural rights provide absolutely no guidance in practice. On the other, natural rights mandate some particular results. They're two specific things. They don't leave legislatures enough flexibility. And neither of those two accounts seems right, given the way we think about rights and lots of practice. And so an example is used often in the scholarship I rely on in the book. Think about speed limits. We all have natural rights to travel and natural rights to be secure in our persons and natural rights to our property. And that doesn't mean if we have a natural right to travel, we have a natural right to travel at any speed we want, no matter the consequences to the common good or others. The natural right to travel has to be coordinated with the natural right to be secure in one's person and the natural right to be secure in one's car. And you need legislation to reconcile, to coordinate the two. There's two sets of rights that travel on one side and secure. A person and property on the other side. And so a justly determined speed limit is a just determination of the three natural rights that speed limits affect if it coordinates travels, life, and property in a way that seems to let people travel with due respect for other people's persons or their property. And the same basic insight applies to all of the messy details of a property system too. Each of them you should be asking, is it facilitating productive use, facilitating clear communication of claims of right, and giving due respect to the claims that are marked off by the sufficiency necessity provisos?
Well, if the positive law system, our constitutional system, translates our natural property rights and indeed our natural rights, all of them, properly into, I'll say, practical workaday specific operational rights, if that translation is done properly, then there's no inherent necessary conflict between the individual's rights and the common good.
That's right, Ken. And in the framework that I'm relying on, a natural right means a right that's ordered as it ought to be consistent with the natural law. And a right that's well ordered in relation to the natural law has to be well ordered. It has to be respectful of the natural rights of other of neighbors besides the right holders and the just interests of the community. And I guess in the book focuses on natural rights and natural law setting standards for property. There's another sense in which natural law and natural rights might be relevant to property law, and that's being part of the source material in law, like in constitutional clauses, like the takings clause in the Fifth Amendment, the privileges or immunities clause of the 14th Amendment, and then property guarantees in state constitutions. the book is focusing more primarily on using natural law, natural rights as standards for asking whether particular institutions and property law are doing what a good system of property should do. The book backs off from making specific claims about what particular constitutional clauses or statutes mean. I'll do that in other scholarship, but the book is it's meant to persuade readers that natural law and natural rights provide satisfying normative standards for seeing whether particular civil laws are just and criticizing them if they're not.
So the translation from natural to positive may or may not be successful.
Correct.
The actions of political authorities and the laws that are passed and the judgments that are written may or may not strike this right balance. And I think there are a couple of examples, one that does and one that doesn't, in your book. With one is on the cover of the book. And could you talk about those two basic examples of a successful or an unsuccessful translation?
Yeah, so Ken's referring to chapter one of the book. When I begin, I start with two examples. One, I think, is a mostly successful legislative scheme to protect and carry natural rights into effect. And another is a legislative scheme that does the opposite. And the one that I think is successful, the technical term of art is unitization of mineral rights in oil and gas. In the book, I call it more colloquially forced pooling, though pooling is a little bit different. It's easier to say pooling than unitization. And the one that's more problematic is the way eminent domain is used when it's used by local governments to condemn private property and then redistribute that private property to private recipients like commercial developers. And that second practice is the one that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 20 years ago to this year in Kelo versus City of New London. And so I begin the book by saying, I lay out why forced pooling and unitization, these are legislative schemes that help secure and carry natural rights into effect. Mineral rights in oil and gas, if they're going to be used productively, the way like all of the uses of oil and gas are consumptive uses, and for making chemicals that have hydrocarbons in them, or for generating energy, and none of these uses can be facilitated without getting the oil or gas up to the surface. And if often landowners have mineral rights beneath their land, and oil and gas are extracted and produced on scales much bigger than the scales of lots. So when Ken put out his copy of the book, at the front of the book, there's a fracking rig. And in the back, there's lots of smaller lots with individual shops or houses on them. And the oil and the gas beneath those houses or those lots need to be organized in rights that are on a lot bigger scale than you need for the secure use of the land and the real estate. And so a just system of regulation says when a state or an energy commission that makes a serious objective and dispassionate judgment that the mineral rights are in positive law are fractionated more than seems likely to maximize the production of oil or gas, there ought to be a way to reorder, to modify in positive law, the positive law mineral rights so that a private oil company can extract them more effectively. But there have to be conditions so this right's not abused. And the main conditions are there needs to be an objective finding by a disinterested actor that the reordering, the modification of rights is necessary. And then the value of those rights needs to be shared with the people who lost those rights. And that happens in all oil and gas schemes that I know of by giving them equitable or prorated interests in the profits from the drilling. now by now to go back, like those same principles you could use to evaluate the condemnation of private land and its redistribution to other private recipients. And but people use land in ways that are much more diverse than people, the way people use oil and gas. And you, in order to protect people's opportunity to put lands to different uses, you have to protect their rights to decide for themselves how to use the land. And so the questions that, like the principles of regulation that you need to use to evaluate oil and gas, you can ask the same questions about the use of eminent domain in local condemnations in private to private transfers. And the showing necessity is really, really hard to make. You need to condemn all of the mineral rights in a shale play to get the last few, to make the drilling possible. You don't need, in the same strict sense, to get every single lot in a neighborhood to get most of the value of a large scale commercial development or a large scale project. And you can see that in the Kelo case itself, the political authorities spared an Italian, the social club called the Italian Dramatic Club. It was a watering hole for local New London politicians. They wanted to go forward with a project to create lots of retail space next to a new office building for Pfizer. And they wanted all this retail space, but they did make an exception for the watering hole for the politicians. Well, if you can make that exception, and that's not going to mar the uniform facade of the retail space that was being built, you could also have spared Suzette Kelo's pink house and the houses of the other people in the neighborhood that would face condemnation in Kelo. And so the chat, like I use those, the a just system of property has to explain why sometimes a state can reorder property rights, like enforced pooling and unitization, and sometimes it shouldn't, as with the most aggressive uses of private to private transfer power and eminent domain. And so the book's trying to lay out the cases when government has legitimate authority to condemn and when it doesn't.
Okay, thank you. But the forced pooling seems, at one level, a little like your speed limit example earlier. I mean, the individual property holders over the shale deposit surrender, or they get their individual rights modified. But as a result of that kind of limitation, they are able to flourish more to a greater extent than had they never done it, and had they not had this forced pooling.
Yeah, that's right, Ken, with a qualification. So forced pooling is like driving in that, or speed limits in that everybody has an interest in driving at some point or another. And so that, like, if you look then at the people who have mineral rights over an oil play or a gas play, they have similar interests. Forced pooling is different in that any energy production it can tax or threaten water supplies, and it can also create pollution. And so there are nuisance complaints. And so the difference is that local residents who don't have mineral rights have with the people who do and with the energy producer, those differences are more pronounced, and those create another set of hard problems. I deal with those later in the book in the chapter on police regulation. Those are the kinds of things you have to deal with well-tailored public law carrying into effect the state's responsibility to protect people from nuisances.
Well, thank you for that correction and clarification. But the conversation so far seems to have been about development, putting idle property, oil deposits, whatever, to economic use. Development, exploitation, drilling, clearing, planting, all for flourishing. But does flourishing always involve use and development and exploitation? What about the case perpetual conservation easements, where the property owner, in return, I think, for a tax break, agrees to limit and agrees to place on that piece of property an easement that will restrict the development of that property forever while he owns it and any subsequent owner. Is that flourishing to restrict development? Because the person who places the easement on the property is, I'll say, happier because he did it.
It's an excellent question. The example is very revealing. And the short answer is, yes, I'm going to draw a distinction between more active and more passive uses of resources. And so the extraction of oil and then the feeding of oil into an engine, those are active uses. Then the shutting down of development on a property so one can enjoy aesthetic benefits from it. One thinks that you're conserving valuable flora and fauna and you get satisfaction from that. Or you like to recreate. Those are more passive uses. And I guess the short version goes like this, one can flourish by passive uses. And a property system should make space for, leave opportunity for passive uses. But passive uses are more problematic than active uses because they are higher maintenance. You need more legal infrastructure to enforce them, and they tend to restrict active uses. And so these passive uses need to be accommodated, but you then need safety valves in law to deal with them. So let me give an example that I cover at greater length in the book that illustrates how to deal with these more passive uses. And that, like, instead of a conservation easement, let's talk about a covenant running with the land to restrict land use to single family residential uses. So lots of people, when they buy into a development, they buy lots, and part of the lot comes with a recorded covenants running with the land. And so anyone who acquires the lot commits to use the land only consistent with single family residential uses, and any other neighbor in the lot can then sue them and hold them accountable if they breach that restriction. So are these running covenants, they are property rights. And they do facilitate productive use. They can flourish being part of a community where all the people put all the land to the same uses. They can flourish by, if you have a residential community, there's certain character to that, and you get gratification from living in that character, being in a place where you're more accountable for your neighbor and their children, and your neighbors are accountable for your children because there are lots of kids there. You can enjoy the quiet that you get not having bars or offices and all the car traffic that comes by. And so a property system needs to facilitate those. You also need claim communication. So you need legal mechanisms, a signpost to anybody who buys in the area. There is an instrument called the running covenant, and we know the obligations that come with it. And you can evaluate whether you want to buy in by having fair notice that you're buying a lot with this. At the same time, in common law property doctrine, running covenants can be terminated by a defense called making a covenant void on the grounds of changed circumstances. And this doctrine is used if it seems that a neighborhood, a lot of people in a neighborhood are not following the covenants, and their neighbors are turning a blind eye. And the concern, there is a concern then that if you keep these covenants longer than is useful, you're restricting the turnover of land so that people who want to use land for some different use have fair opportunity to get land. And so the sufficiency proviso puts some outer time limit on how long running covenants can be valid. So you can apply the same way of thinking to conservation easements. So should there be a space in a legal system for conservation easements? Yes, because people can flourish by enjoying land in its undeveloped state, seeing the being satisfied that flora and fauna that might be threatened are have a better chance to be conserved. But if like it could be that if you have too many plots of land under conservation easements, you choke the opportunities of a future generation to acquire land for more active uses. And so you might want to have some safety valve. And the book doesn't cover conservation easements, but the book's way of thinking about rights that are prima facie valid and then defenses and safety valves later give you a way of thinking about it. And so those are that's the framework you'd apply to conservation easements.
Thank you. Now, let's check with Edith Harold, our control operator, to see if we have any questions for Eric that have been submitted thus far by the listening audience.
Well, Edie, before you do that, there's a couple of other topics I want to get out just to make sure people understand the book. So Ken asked a lot of questions about natural law and natural rights, and that's part one of the book. And he asked about like how one acquires a natural right to property, and that's part two of the book, chapters 4-7. But he talked about this process of translation, and the last seven substantive chapters talk about that. So part three of the book is how do natural property rights get converted into law? And they tackle questions like, how can one justify the conventional legal institution of ownership with a natural right to use property? How do ownership rights get limited by having broad public commonses, by having common carrier doctrines with like narrow limits, letting a good faith mistaken improver keep what he's mistakenly improved by adverse possession doctrines? And then there's a lot of details about like lesser property rights than ownership in chapter 11, like the lease, the running covenant that Ken and I were just talking about, easements. The fee simple that are limited by the fee simple determinable in life estates. And then the last part of the book, chapters 12, 13, and 14, show how property rights get implemented in other parts of law. And I cover the tort law, like how property rights generate a tort doctrine of nuisance. And then chapter 13 talks about how property rights give you principles for regulating property. And that has important overtones for takings doctrine and regulatory takings. And then chapter 14 finishes where the book starts with Kelo and forced pooling. How do property rights give a system of law guidance when a use of eminent domain is just and when it's not? So that's a rule out of the books. And with that, I want to take Ken's hint. We should give the audience, members of the audience, chances to ask questions too.
Well, yes. Let me say something before we finally let Edith answer. I will say that rollout, that overview of the structure and the topics covered from chapter to chapter, just illustrate in the strongest terms what a resource this book is for all of the audiences that you mentioned. Just it's an incredible piece of work, really.
Edith. Absolutely. And it looks like we do have a few questions from the audience. And just a reminder, if you have a question, you can enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. Jeff Wood asks, how do you deal with property rights that economists would describe as public goods?
Thanks to Jeff for the question. It's a great one. And there's a few, I guess, a short answer and then several threads of longer answer. So the short answer is a complete system of property needs to have space for government-owned property and for different regimes that might be called commons regimes. And chapter 9, so to the two chapters on ownership are 8 and 9, and 8 makes the case for ownership and 9 makes the case for limits on ownership. And one major limit on ownership is that sometimes the best way to facilitate the productive use of resources is to leave resources in government-owned property or to leave them in commonses. And here again, the elements of natural rights provide a guide for this. Some resources, like they've got a few obvious uses, and you don't need private property to facilitate those uses. John Locke is the greatest champion of property there ever was. But in section 30 of the second treatise, he talks about some resources that must avoidably remain in common. And he talks about oceans. Why? Because the main use of an ocean is for transportation with boat traffic. And here Locke is following Grotius and Pufendorf. So when the productive use element, when you can see that the main likely uses are uses that where you need a network, then private property might get in the way and a broad commons is better. And there are also some uses that might be hard to mark off with clear claims and signposting. And it's hard to mark an ocean off like this too. So in principle, that's the answer. And then sometimes the way to use property is to secure other rights, like letting people travel or securing everybody's. We all have natural rights of self-defense, but we can secure those better by having one military for the whole country. And so you need public roads and you need military bases, and the government runs the public roads and the government runs the military bases. So the use element and the claim communication element provide guideposts, and then you need to have reasoned argument about when the uses are better structured in commons and when they're better structured through private property. Now, another part of Jeff's question is he mentioned economists, and I try to focus on telling my story about natural law and natural rights. But since this is written for a lot of academics, they're going to ask questions like, what do we have to learn from natural law and natural rights that we can't learn from other modern ways of thinking about property? And one of those is law and economics. And to that, I would say that the best law and economists, the ones I consider most modest and doing the most durable work, they're careful to understand that law and economics gives helpful technical advice, but it doesn't give a satisfying account of why law is a just institution. Law and economics works best in a secondary framework if you already have a satisfying account why people are valuable, what activities of people are valuable, and what rights people ought to have. In that framework, then law and economics can help you figure out how to structure legal institutions on the basis of the rights. And the people, the kinds of economists they're talking about today, Henry Smith at Harvard, Bob Ellickson now emeritus at Yale, but going back, Adam Smith at the beginning of the economic tradition. Not all economists are like that. With those economists, I have more disagreement. So I would resist the economist public good framework makes sense on the basis of moral principles that Adam Smith would agree with, Richard Posner might not.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. We have a question about collectivizing property rights. So Adam McLeod writes that the example of combining fractional mineral rights works because the uses of those rights all amount to the same thing, which is exploiting the oil and gas for its market value. And as you pointed out, other property uses are not commensurable in that way. So he asks, how often are property uses likely to be commensurable so that collective restructuring of property rights could be justified, and how frequently might this actually happen?
Thanks for the question. It's from Adam McLeod at University of St. Mary's in Texas. He's written his own fine book that called Property and Practical Reason, Cambridge 2015. I learned a lot from it and engaged with it in my book. The question he asked is to the heart of things. It's perceptive and it's hard. So again, short answer and a longer answer. So the short answer is, as a rule of thumb, I think it's safer to presume that people's uses are not commensurable. They cannot be aligned with each other. And so the safer play is to give people rights to decide for themselves how they want to use their resources. And it's the rare exceptional case that uses are commensurable. So the kilo rubbed a lot of ordinary people the wrong way, because land on the surface is the kind of resource that 1,000 people can put to 2,000 different uses. And we have common law doctrines of trespass and nuisance that let people be left alone to decide for themselves how to use their own. And it's an exceptional case when we're sure that that mineral rights are all going to be put to the same uses. And so the doctrines I talked about for like those principles of regulation that explain why forced pooling or unitization law might be legitimate, and the kinds of private to private transfer schemes you see in Kilo aren't. The first is working with a resource where all the people are using it the same way, and the second, it's not. So like, I guess the longer answer is a property, like any system of law has to deal with this problem, speed limits. Again, you take 1 million people. I'm sure that you've got 1 million different trade-offs between they all have different thresholds where they'd say, okay, I like driving 100 miles an hour in Montana on a highway. And other people are like, no, I still want to drive 30 on that interstate in Montana. And so incommensurability cannot be a devastating objection to stop a legislature from setting a speed limit that's going to affect hundreds, thousands, millions of people. So too with property. But what I think a decent system of property can do is say, let's try to create a right and structure the right to leave people to decide for themselves how to use the resource. But then we need to, when people engage in these uses, if there's any spillover on other people's property, then we need generalized standards to talk about that. And that's where you get nuisance law. And we need to have a homogeneous understandings of nuisance law so that people can understand their obligations and their rights under nuisance law. And so you can work out general standards of nuisance the way you have spent general speed limits. So the system is trying to protect people's rights to engage in incommensurable uses, but then you can justify having broad homogeneous rights and broad homogeneous side constraints on those rights. And those are justified on the grounds that we're letting as many people as possible make their own choices to pursue their own incommensurable uses. And if we can't let every single particular idiosyncratic person pursue her incommensurable use, that we at that system, we cannot let the best be the enemy of the good.
Wonderful. Thank you. Now we have a bit of a broader question. Someone asks, how would you characterize your understanding of natural law and natural rights in comparison with the various formulations of utilitarianism?
Natural law and natural law, as I understand it, it's an approach, and in it, let me start here. Normative philosophy, there's three very broad families of thinking about the ways of grounding different normative theories. And the grounds start with, but there's some question, you keep asking a series of questions. Why are you making an argument that something is normatively desirable? And I cover this in chapter 2 of the book. So the last answer is because it just makes sense. There's a logical structure to morality, and my prescriptions are consistent with the inner structure of morality. And those theories are often called Kantian or deontological. In another line of question, answer, it's because my way of thinking or my proposal is going to produce good consequences for all the people affected. Those are called consequentialism. And the third approach is because the most important point about a normative theory about that has to do with people is helping people flourish, become better people. And those approaches are called eudaimonistic or perfectionist or natural law related. Utilitarian is in the second family. It's consequentialist. And the natural law counts in the third family for eudaimonist or perfectionist. And so utilitarians have to ask questions if you're saying that utility counts, why is utility valuable? And when different people have different utilities, how do you reconcile the different people's utility preferences? If a utilitarian says, well, I'm for the greatest good for the greatest number, then there's a sharp contrast between utilitarianism and natural law. If a utilitarian concedes, Yeah, I mean by utility, something, a kind of utility that's grounded in human reason is objectively defensible. And I recognize that different people can have different preferences, and you need to give space to rights for people to pursue different courses of action. That's a kind of utilitarianism that I think is natural law, but it's got a utilitarian window dressing.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And I think we have time for our last question, which is perfect. Richard Epstein has made the argument that John Locke would make a good Marxist when he grounds creation of property rights through the admixture of one's labor with goods from the storehouse of nature. And he points to earlier Roman law as a better source. Do you address this in your book, and do you have a reaction to it?
Yes. So Richard is a mentor and a colleague and a friend. He mangles Locke on several occasions. And I cite this. Richard is following Robert Nozick, and Robert Nozick critiques Lockean labor theory in Anarchy, State of Utopia. And Epstein follows Nozick's critique in some of his writings. And I cover those in chapter 5. With all respect and affection to Epstein, he doesn't treat Locke's account of labor charitably. And this is another one of the devastating threshold objections that I needed to write a book to deal with. So in a charitable understanding of labor theory, in the Epstein-Nozick account, labor is any old activity on a resource, whether it's productive and no matter what the effects on other. So Nozick has this example where he pours a can of tomato juice with radioactive carbon molecules into a sea. And Nozick says, does that mean he appropriated the poor appropriated the sea? And if labor is understood consistent with the principles of the natural law, no. Is pouring something away, is that productive use? No. So that's one ground why you don't appropriate the sea. And then second, is that kind of pouring consistent with our ordinary expectations about signposting your claims that you own something, like putting up a fence or a sign? No, you've just dissipated something. You haven't created a sign. And if you claim the sea, are you claiming something consistent with others' like needs? And so the sufficiency proviso, no, you're not. So the productive use claim communication and the sufficiency proviso provide the answers that Nozick and Epstein don't think about, because they're not being charitable to Locke. And I think that Roman law, as Epstein talks about it, there's not yet a discrete concept of property in Roman law. There are several topics in Roman law that, if you add them together, are what become property by the 1700s. But if you look at those topics are treated, they organize property rights and the limits on property rights consistent with the norms about use and claim communication I talk about in the book. So I think Roman law and a charitable understanding of Locke give Epstein what he wants, and as against the portrait of Locke that he provides, I don't think is charitable.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much on behalf of the Federalist Society for being here and speaking with us today about your new publication. We're really grateful for your time and expertise in this great conversation. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more, everyone, for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thanks. Well, one more real quick. Cambridge University on the website now. You can buy a hard copy for the next year, and you can buy a soft copy at about a quarter of the price a year from now, and you can get digital access via libraries. But thanks again to the Federalist Society for having me, and thanks to Ken for his sympathetic and thoughtful commentary.
Thank you,
Bob. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.